Well, thank you for inviting me, and I think it would behoove me to first define what I mean by an experimental model, since that's the subject of my talk. By an experimental model, I mean one that is developed, as the speakers before me said, in close association with experiments, and that is used as a way of organizing the data that one accumulates in experiments and for predicting things about the system that are not apparent, that are testable with experiments. So the interplay then between experiments and theory defines an experimental model. And the other thing I'd like to do is maybe say to you all how I got into the field of computational neuroscience. I was trained as a neuroscientist and electrophysiologist, and for years was quite content to simply do experiments. Then I had the good fortune of being associated with a number of students, starting with Eric DeShooter, who came to me as an undergraduate, actually, and spent 10 years on and off in my lab teaching me or computational neuroscience as he was learning it, and then followed by mathematicians like Farzan Nadim, who spent a couple of years in my lab, and then Gennady Symbolyuk, another mathematician who spent years in my lab, and now Andre Olafer, who is in the audience here, another mathematician. So what I've done for them, they've taught me theory, they've taught me how to think like a theorist, what I've done for them is to force them sometimes with a ruler in hand to do experiments. And I think that there's no substitute if you're a theorist for actually doing some experiments, because I think the respect that you develop for data and the limitations of data are very important. So just a little bit of the end at the beginning to say what my perspective is about how to get into the field. If you're a biologist, then your problem is mine. You have to have people who have stronger backgrounds in theory. I couldn't agree more than with what Andre said about how undergraduates need to be exposed more to the physical sciences. Okay, so I'm the kind of biologist who's been interested in one biological problem, and I've used that biological problem to move me along through my career. It's been my interest and my passion, and then I've applied many different approaches from the biochemical to the computational to understanding this. And what I'm interested in is the idea of motor pattern generation, and the animal that I work with is the leech, and I'm interested in these two longitudinal blood vessels that propel blood through the closed circulatory system and the neuronal network that controls those vessels. I'm not going to tell you much about that neuronal network. I'm going to focus on a very small part of it and talk about a model that we've developed over the years and that we continue to use, I hope, quite fruitfully. Let's go on from there. The basic idea is that there are a set of inner neurons in this nervous system that paces the heartbeat, and that the real pacemakers are two pairs of interneurons, which we call 3 and 4, and I color code everything here as much as possible. The threes are color coded blue. Those two pairs of interneurons, 3 and 4, make mutual inhibitory connections. So we heard a lot about that from Hugh, mutual inhibition, and that leads to oscillation in this case. And here shown with the two different ways that we record from the cells, either extracellularly or intracellularly, and you can see the two cells here, and their mutual inhibition leads to oscillation. Many years ago, we started work on a model of these neurons. Here shown with two intracellular recordings, and we've incorporated all the different ionic currents that we've been able to describe using voltage clamp experiments into this model, and the synaptic currents that are involved into the model. And these are all described by a standard now in the field for cellular neuroscience, the Hodgkin-Huxley equation. And the model has activity which is similar to that seen in the living system. And this just shows you one of the beauties of having such a model, that you can look at the underlying current flows. And I want to focus your attention on just two of those current flows. But first, I want to step back and show you something that had a very profound effect on me. I might say even shook me to my core, because here I had been studying this model, which produces this wonderful activity that's so much like what the nervous system actually does, and where I've studied the underlying current flows. And then along comes Astrid Prince and Eve Martyr and their colleagues working on such models and using database approaches and showing that there is an enormous number of similar parameter sets that characterize such a model. Here is a simple one neuron model from a somatic gastric ganglion neuron, and it can produce bursts of various different complexity, or it can be tonically active, or it can be silent, this is in a mapping of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 dimensional parameter space, showing where the different activity can occur. And you can see that there are many, many different sets of parameters shown in this stacking diagram that will allow you to get very similar activity. So what then can be the future of an experimental model of the sort that I spent half my career developing, when in fact this is possible? And so is this a brave new world that has such models in it, or are we to be vexed to nightmare by an expanding database? And in fact, what I've done is something like this. I've taken one of these little itty-bitty points here, and this is my neighborhood that my model sits in right here. In itself, it has a tremendous diversity. So, and just to show you an example of the kind of diversity that can occur there, what I've done is I've taken that model. I haven't done this. Gennady Symbolyuk in the lab did it. And I've just looked at two different parameters, the amount of the leak current and the reversal potential of that current, and just changed them over a reasonable physiological range. And you can see that a single neuron from one of those mutually inhibitory pairs can either be tonically spiking, it can be bursting in a very narrow window of parameters, or it can be silent. You can see that the model, when it's up in this region here, produces this activity. This is a single neuron from such a model, and when it's down in this region here with the asterisk, with the diamond, rather, it produces this activity. So, this corresponds to something we can see in the living system. Here, an intracellular and an extracellular recording from two neurons of these mutually inhibitory pairs, and we put in bifuculine, which blocks the inhibitory synapses, and you see the intracellular recording becomes tonically active, and the extracellular recording remains bursting, although its characteristics change in that the off period is greatly shortened. And then when you wash out, it returns. So basically, then, there's enough of leak introduced just by the recording technique to force the neurons out from one area of the parameter space to another. And in fact, there are indications that maybe the neurons themselves move around in parameter space. Here you see that here are two neurons in a control. We both recorded extracellularly. We blocked the synapses with bicuculine. They continue to burst, as you would expect from the previous slide. Both are extracellularly recorded. But look, you know, they can go into these times where they do not burst but fire tonically, and then they'll recover and come back and burst. And this is seen here in this expanded region of this record. And then when you wash out the drug, then they return to alternating bursting again. So it may be that the neurons themselves are non-stationary and that they run around in this parameter space that we've described. So what then are we to do with such a wonderful model if parameters can be quite variable and the underlying activity of individual neurons can vary quite a bit? Well, what we've done is we've just boldly gone ahead and tried to use models that we thought were tuned to what was going on experimentally. And by that we mean that we constantly adjust the model to the latest set of experiments so that we know we are in a parameter regime that corresponds to all of the data that we've been able to generate. So it may mean a reevaluation sometimes of parameters, but I think it's a worthwhile endeavor, and I think that one has to have a benchmark model to use for experiments. And then if you continue to do experiments and push the model, you can then learn some things about it. I want to point out two currents that flow during this oscillation that lead to the oscillation itself. And these two currents are both relatively slow. One is a current that's active during the inhibited phase. It's turned on by hyperpolarization. It slowly activates, and then it helps the neuron to escape from the inhibition of the other cell. It's an inward current called the H current. It's a positive or inward current. And the other is a current that's active during the burst phase and, in fact, promotes the burst phase. It's a low-threshold calcium current, and it is driven to threshold and drives the burst and then slowly inactivates during the burst, leading to a spike frequency adaptation. So like Hugh was saying, in mutually inhibitory neurons in cortex, there's a spike frequency adaptation. And that here is due to the inactivation of an inward current, not due to the buildup of an outward current or potassium current. But it's the same idea, really. And so this inhibition gets weaker and weaker on the other cell until you reach a critical frequency here in which the inhibition is so weak that the other cell's tendency to escape due to the buildup of this H current can cause it to fire. So that's what the model tells us about this. And then, as Gennady would tell me, is if you're looking at a system that has slow dynamics, look for the slowest time constant and you'll have the answer. And so that's something I've learned over the years. Just look for the slow time constant. And the slowest time constant is this time constant, the inactivation here of that current. So when we look at this now from the point of view of what's going on in the burst of this cell, the slow inactivation of this current and the spike frequency adaptation, the waning of inhibition in the other cell, meanwhile the other cell has activated its H current and sits around waiting until a certain level of inhibition comes. Okay, well, if you have that's just embodied then here in these graphs, which show that if you vary the amount of the H current, then you can change the period of the system in a nice continuous way, and you also change that critical frequency. That is, what critical frequency can you escape from? The more H current you have, you can escape from a greater critical frequency. On the other hand, you can change the inactivation time constant of the calcium current, and it will not influence at all the critical frequency, but it grades the period. And so we just have used this model then in a hybrid system approach. And I think this is one of the critical ways that you can test an experimental model, is to use it in conjunction with living cells and see whether it holds up under experimental conditions. So here then, the model can run in real time. In some cases, we've used an analog computation of the cell, and others a digital one. It doesn't really matter. You isolate the cell, the living cells, from one another by blocking their synapses. You create artificial synapses between the model neuron, always in red, and the living neuron, always in blue. And when you turn on the artificial synapses, then these cells will go into oscillation. It won't show my slides. Wow. Okay. I don't know why it does that, but this computer doesn't do it. Well, those slides showed you varying the H current, and they had the predicted results. That is, when you varied the H current, either in the model neuron or the living neuron using this dynamic clamp technique, then you what you did was you changed the period and in a predictable way, and you altered the final frequency or critical frequency at which an escape occurred. And I can't show you those slides because the computer won't accept those, but here I'll show you the same thing now done by Andre Olafer, who's in the audience here, varying the time constant of that inactivation of the slow calcium current, the low threshold calcium current. And we just did that by multiplying this time constant, which is a voltage-dependent time constant, by a constant factor. Ooh, that should be a 4, sorry. You can see here that the living neuron and the model neuron are well balanced at our sort of standard setting for that parameter. That is, their burst durations are nearly equivalent. So, again, it sort of supports the idea that we're pretty close to where we should be in a parameter space. Now, if we change the time constant of inactivation in the model neuron and make it faster, then you see that burst duration decreases, whereas the burst duration of the other cell, the living cell, barely changes, and the period is adjusted. Now, if we make it a lot slower, that corresponds to this one where I have that typo, then you see that the burst duration of the model neuron greatly increases because it takes longer and longer and longer and longer and longer for it to get to the critical frequency at which this cell can escape. So we asymmetrically change the system so that the burst duration of the altered neuron is changed. But the critical frequency doesn't change here. Okay. Now you can do the same thing in the living neuron. You can block that current in the living neuron and then add it back. You block the current with manganese and then you add it back with dynamic clamp and you get the corresponding answer. When we increase the time constant of inactivation in the living neuron, we increase its burst duration, we increase the period of the entire system, and we don't change the final critical frequency. And nothing really occurs with the model neuron. So I think that this is is something which more and more people are starting to do, which is to use their experimentally based models in hybrid systems to get a deeper understanding of what's going on at the neuronal network level. All right. So then, here then is the model again, and now I want to get back to, are we really faced with the kinds of problems which seem to be apparent from the work that Astrid Prinz, who's in the audience here, and her colleagues who work together at Brandeis. Now Astrid, fortunately, has joined us at Emory, so she's a colleague and on my side. So that's really good. Do we really experience that? Well, Annalise Tobin, who was in the lab, she was a graduate student, and she did these experiments. We never thought to analyze the data this way until she joined Eve's lab, Eve Marver's lab, and then they looked at our data and they said, well, look, you know, the synaptic strength between these two neurons in preparations that look identical, look at the burst durations, look at the frequencies, look at the periods. They're really nearly identical, but this synapse in this preparation is, you know, twice the size of that synapse. And yet the system seems to be nearly identical. So, and then you add on to this another piece of work from Annalise's thesis, the fact that one of the currents, which I just showed you, is absolutely critical for defining the period and the characteristics of the system, the H current. Unfortunately, my slides didn't show. It is, in fact, modulated by chemicals like myomodulin and others that modify the period of the system. So the system doesn't want to stay at one particular period. It wants to be modifiable. And if you put on myomodulin, you speed up the oscillation, and you do that by increasing, shown here in voltage clamp records, the amount of this H current, or the current that's activated by hyperpolarization and helps the cell to recover. So how are we to put all of this together? I've shown you that we have inherent variability within the system, we have modulation within the system, and indeed the underlying characteristics of the neurons are tuned in this biological system very close to bifurcations that change their inherent dynamics. And just to remind you of that, they are tuned in such a way that there's only a very narrow region in which they could burst within this parameter regime, and in fact they may wander around in that parameter space. Well, the first thing is that once you put the synapses into the system, then if those synapses are relatively strong, then the regime for bursting in this little network of mutually inhibitory neurons is tremendously expanded within this plane. And in fact, if you induce some leak in the cells by sticking them artificially with a microelectrode in a model experiment and causing a large change in the leak, then they still would burst, because the network itself then overrides these inherent properties. The other thing that I would point out is, and here I want to recognize Andre Olafer and his poster number 165 on Monday, little advertisement there, is that within this area of parameter space, in fact, the models behave relatively similar, at least from the point of view of what is the period of the system. You see, all these neurons would be tonically active if they were isolated, all these would be bursters if they were isolated, and all these would be silent if they were isolated, yet they all have about the same period, or nearly the same period, when you put them into a network. So does that mean that it's irrelevant where they are within this regime, within this parameter space? Probably not, because if you look a little more deeply, what you find is that the sensitivity to a change in the H current of the period is quite different for the neurons in this regime of parameter space. You see here, that's true, but it doesn't seem to be, because the size of these circles indicates this sensitivity. And it's not really related to whether they're silent cells or bursters or tonically active, but rather related to how, where they sit in this plane. So the underlying bifurcations of the neuronal properties are not important, but hidden beneath this similarity in activity is, in fact, would be a quite a bit of difference in respect to their ability to respond to a modulator that influenced IH. And here then is another example from Andre's work, and where we took that current, that synaptic current, and we reduced it by 40%. That's essentially that variability I showed you in the synaptic strength. And that immediately causes a 7% reduction in the period and a 3% increase in the average spike frequency. Well, then through the magic of homeostatic regulation, Andre readjusted all the other two other parameters here, the amount of the inactivation of that slow calcium current and the amount of H current, those two other parameters, and got the cells to be exactly the same as they used to be. So now these cells are exactly the same. They have exactly the same characteristics as they used to have here, but they have these different synaptic strengths that correspond to the kind of variability that we see. So are these exactly equivalent models, or do they represent really truly different states of the system? And if you look again at the sensitivity then to a change in H current, then there is a 20% change in that sensitivity. With when you reduce the synaptic strength as we did, then you actually become much more sensitive to a modulator. So I guess then in summing up, what I would say is that when you're doing an experimental model, you necessarily are constrained by, I think, the system that you work with. And if you continue to press the model with experiments, continue to press it, to look in a rather local neighborhood of a huge parameter space. On the other hand, I don't think that one can truly use a model in the way that we've tried to use it unless you do restrict yourself in that way. So there is a dynamic there which is really difficult. We have to think globally about the entire set of possibilities for a model and for the biological system that it models, but we have to act globally act locally within an experimental context. And a major problem that will exist for all of us is how to balance the idea that certain key parameters are going to be modulated over broad ranges. We showed that, and that the system is going to have to be able to accommodate that in face of the variability that it has in its inherent parameters. So that's basically what I had to say. I can just add to what Andre said, which is that over the years I've had the great pleasure of working with many people who have entered the field of computational neuroscience at the Woods Hole Neural Systems and Behavior course. Maurice Chacon was one of the students who I happened to have at one time, and I think that's a great idea to go to these summer schools and to, especially courses like that, where they try to train people who come from very diverse backgrounds in the basic biology of a system. And also that the transition is extremely difficult. I learned that for myself because I've had to force myself to think in completely different ways. And I see that all the time teaching a computational neuroscience course at Emory, where I'm often embarrassed when I grade homeworks by the computational ability of my students compared to myself. But then a sort of shock at their biological naivete. And I'm sure they see it exactly the opposite way. So it's a very difficult transition and marriage, but one I think that's well worth it. Thanks. Yes. Right, so for the synaptic strength, I think that the model can accommodate. I think that what Andre has been showing shows that for the synaptic strength, and I hope I tried to show that.